Граждане России.
В Москве мощным взрывом полностью уничтожен девятиэтажный жилой дом.
Первые жертвы обнаружили еще до рассвета.
Первые съемки на месте трагедии.
Мощный взрыв разрушил всю центральную часть девятиэтажного
жилого дома. Ранним утром 16 сентября для Волгодонска.
It was 2 weeks that shocked the world and 2 weeks that shook and changed Russia. A wave of terror that launched a war and a wave of fear and anger that made a president. 17 years ago this week, a series of apartment bombings in Moscow and other cities commenced, killing nearly 300 people and altering the course of Russian history. So what do the dramatic, frightening, and disturbing events of September 1999 tell us about Vladimir Putin's Russia today? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi there, Brian.
And joining us via Skype from London is somebody who has probably done more research in this topic than anybody alive. David Satter is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute and a fellow at the Foreign Policy Institute of Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. He's also the author of 2 books about the 1999 apartment bombings, Darkness at Dawn, and the recently published The Less You Know, The Better You Sleep. Welcome back to the podcast, David, and congratulations on the new book.
Thank you, Brian.
Thanks for coming on. And joining us also from Washington, D.C. is veteran Kremlin watcher Donald Jensen, a former U.S. State Department official and currently a fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations at the Nietzsche School of International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Welcome back to the podcast, Don.
Good morning, Brian.
Good morning, or good afternoon from where we're sitting. So David, let's start with you, since you've been writing about this quite a bit. And let's start with the basics. The 1999 apartment bombings played a huge, if not decisive, role in Vladimir Putin's rise to power. You've made no secret of the fact that you think these bombings were an inside job, and I should add that you are hardly alone in that assessment. You've written extensively about why, based on the evidence, you think this is the case. Can you spell this out for our listeners who may not be familiar with all the gory details of this? Why does this look like an inside job to you?
Oh, there are many reasons, but I think the 3 most convincing are the fact that the KGB was caught planting a bomb in a basement in the city of Ryazan. And that bomb was tested positive for hexagon. That was the high explosive that was used in the 4 preceding bombs. Of course, after the fact, they said that the bomb was made of sugar, that the test was incorrect. But in fact, the test results were registered, and the bomb was photographed and time-stamped. And it was clear that it had an active and highly professional military detonator. In addition to that, Gennady Selesnyov, the Speaker of the Duma, announced the bombing of the building in Volgodonsk 3 days before it occurred. He confused the bombing that had taken place on September 13th, which was a Moscow bombing, the blowing up of a building on Kashirskaya Chasse, with the planned bombing that was due to take place on September 16th. Well, on September 16th, the building in Volgodonsk was blown up, raising the question of how is it possible that he knew about a bombing that hadn't even taken place. And finally, the photograph, the sketch of the person who rented the basement in the building in Moscow on Ulitsa Goryanova Street, on Ulitsa Goryanova, was removed from circulation by the FSB, and a falsified picture was substituted. And this is according to the testimony of the person who actually rented the basement out and saw the person who reserved that basement where the bomb was placed. All of this plus enormous circumstantial evidence, in fact, really leaves little doubt to, I believe, to any objective observer or anyone who has the wherewithal to study the evidence, that this was a terrorist attack carried out by the Russian leadership against their own people.
And I would also add to that, David, in July 1999, just 2 months before the bombing, the newspaper Moskovskaya Pravda published an article by retired General Alexander Zhilin, in which the article was titled Storm in Moscow, in which he predicted a wave of terrorist attacks in Moscow and aimed at discrediting the Yuri Lushkov, the mayor of Moscow, and Yevgeny Primakov, the former prime minister at that time, who both were seen as the most likely to rise to power after Yeltsin fell, and the Yeltsin family was quite fearful of that. Now there's a lot of stuff like this in the Russian press all the time. The thing about the Zhilin article is that it came true. The prediction pretty much came true. Mark, what about you? Are you convinced that there's no smoking gun on one hand, but on the other hand, this, as David notes, the circumstantial evidence is pretty overwhelming that this was an inside job. This is a false flag.
Yes, I think this is one of those beyond reasonable doubt cases. I mean, the academic in me would love to actually have that clear, absolutely unequivocal proof. And let's be honest, at some point, because everything eventually leaks, at some point that will come out. But for the moment, I don't think there's any question but that there's a massive balance of probabilities is that this was indeed a state-run or state agencies-run terror campaign.
Don, what about you? I mean, are you convinced as well? Because I just really want to establish, if we're going to proceed from the notion that this was an inside job. I basically want to establish that we're all on the same page.
Yeah, of course I'm convinced, as I think Mark said. Circumstantial evidence holds up in a court of law, too, even without a smoking gun. And the evidence is indeed overwhelming, absolutely.
Right, and I would also add to this that almost every Russian who's tried to investigate this, Sergei Yushchenkov, Yuri Shekhachekin, Anna Politkovskaya, Alexander Litvinenko, have wound up dead one way or the other. And that also adds to the suspicion of this. Now that we've established that, let's move from the specific to the larger picture, because that's what I really wanted to discuss today. And once we've established that we all see this the same way, what relevance do these 17-year-old events have for us today? What kind of insight, retrospectively, do they provide into the way Putin has governed? Was this Putin's original sin, so to speak? David, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, this is the central act of post-Soviet Russia. This is an act of terror carried out by the government, which confirmed the Yeltsin system and created the basis for the Putin system. It implicates not just Putin, it also implicates Yeltsin, because Putin at the time was a functionary. He could not have carried out those attacks on his own initiative. The initiative came from Yeltsin and his entourage. So one very important conclusion that needs to be drawn is that there is a line of continuity between the criminal Yeltsin regime and the criminal Putin regime.
This is unquestionably, in my view, the greatest provocation since the burning of the Reichstag. And it was critical for Russia's post-Soviet development. It confirmed the corrupt Yeltsin system, and it created the basis for the further criminalization of the country and the extinguishment of liberty under Putin. But the important thing to bear in mind is that it's also the link between the Yeltsin period and the Putin period. These two periods are too often seen as separate, when in fact they are directly connected, and the connecting link is the murder of 300 people in 1999. The criminalization of Russia under Yeltsin needed to be protected, and who better to protect it than the masters of provocation, i.e. the KGB, which is now known as the FSB. So this incident is not trivial. It's not something that should be overlooked. It's not something that should be ignored because we can say, well, we don't have 100% proof, which is always interpreted as meaning that no one has produced a videotape of the perpetrators carrying out the crime, which is a standard that is impossible to apply to virtually any crime, because without really treating these events at their full value, we can only end up with a distorted picture of Russia itself, distorted in a direction that leads us to believe that we can make deals with the Russian regime, that we don't have to deter the Russian regime, that the Russian regime is part of the civilized world. Well, none of those things are true.
Mark, I see you're writing, so which means you definitely have something intelligent to say. Well, let's start with the same question. Was this Putin's original sin?
Well, I would very much agree with David on the point that this is not so much Putin's original sin, though obviously he was the beneficiary of it, so much as Yeltsin's final toxic bequest. Because you have to realize Putin was plucked from relative obscurity for this position. It was a time when he was not the mover and shaker. We now tend to think of Putin always as the pivotal figure, but he wasn't then. This was put together by others. This is not something that he could have created himself, which obviously in no way exonerates him from responsibility. But I think exactly, I think we have to realize this is part and parcel of the transition of one unpleasant regime to a different kind of unpleasant regime. And in that respect, I think I probably, without in any way downplaying this, I think I'd say that in some ways it's just one of a variety.
And this is what we're going to get into in the second half, talking about the whole continuity.
Exactly. But I think, you know, when it comes down to it, what we have to realize is Putin did not organize this. Or if he organized it, it was purely the nuts and bolts senses. He could not have been the prime mover behind it. So in this respect, I'd absolutely agree with David.
Well, yeah, and it goes going back to that Moskovska Komsomolska piece, Storm in Moscow, by retired General Alexander Zhilin, that I noted earlier. One of the arguments that this article was basically, it was, why was Sergei Stepashin, who had been prime minister, of course, before Putin in the summer of 1999, why was he fired in August of 1999? Why did Putin trade 140-something security chief from Petersburg for another 40-something security chief from Petersburg? Mm-hmm. Basically because Sergei Stepashin and Putin had similar backgrounds. And Zhilin offers the argument that basically Stepashin wasn't really down with what was about to happen, and Putin was. And so this article is more, as much about warning that these terrorist attacks are coming in Moscow as saying the reason they're coming is because now there's a guy that's prime minister that is willing to let this happen.
Yes, I mean, this is it, and it speaks to precisely Putin's initial role that we sometimes forget, which is that he was the bagman, he was the protector, he was the guy who was willing to say and promise whatever needed to be said and whatever needed to be promised precisely to get that position. He turned out actually to be quite a disloyal client afterwards. There is no honour among thieves. But definitely, you know, we have to realise that at this point you might say he was a relatively lesser piece who was being traded up and turned into the king. Mm-hmm. He was definitely not the master of the board.
Mm-hmm. Don, your thoughts, the relevance of this today? What does this show us about?
Extremely relevant. I have a number of points to make, but you want to talk about continuity later, and we can do that then. But I want to highlight my agreement with Mark on the issue of what happened that summer. I was following the Luzhkov, we call it campaign, very closely at the time. And when was the Zhilin article? In July?
July, yeah.
Putin had almost no poll rating positive till after this happened in September. And I very much agree that this could not have been organized by Putin directly. He must have gone along with it because he had really no political standing among all the players at the time at all. And I think, as Mark said, they probably picked him, or he went along with it. But who they are, we kind of pieced together in subsequent years, but who they are likely confirms the continuity of the leaders, the elites, from one era to another. I would also add that I don't think Putin's always in charge of everything now, but certainly he's in charge of most things. And it was really, if you look at his poll rating, it was really after September 9th that it took off. He was politically sort of nothing before, except, I think, a useful tool for other players.
Right. And today, as we're recording today, September 9th, is the anniversary of the first Moscow bombing. Another thing I kind of wanted to get into here was that this was almost a harbinger of a lot of different things that were, you know, not necessarily as spectacular of this, but things that we kind of associate with the Putin regime. The role of dramaturgia, kind of manufactured crises, that has been a hallmark of the Putin regime, the role of false flags, which has been a hallmark of the Putin regime, the notion of government by spetsoperatsia, you know, government by special operations. This is the mother of all special operations, is another hallmark of the Putin regime. And another thing is the sense is there are no limits to what you can do to protect your interests while you're in power. In this way, this was a harbinger in a lot of other more banal aspects of the Putin the Putin's rule. David, would you agree with that?
Well, this was not the last provocation. It was followed by Nordost, by Beslan. It followed by the war, the invasion of eastern Ukraine, and the takeover of Crimea, which were also provocations. In other words, the way of ruling was determined by the events of 1999. But more to the point, it confirmed the most dangerous legacy of the communist period, which is that the individual human being is just raw material for the achievement of the political goals of whoever happens to be in power. The idea that lives don't matter, it doesn't matter if you blow up 300 randomly chosen people, it doesn't matter if you gas a theater full of helpless hostages, or you use flamethrowers on a gymnasium in a school that's packed with hostages, both parents and children, or if you give anti-aircraft weapons to a collection of marginals in eastern Ukraine, knowing full well that they're going to be aimed at one of the most heavily traveled air routes in the world, or that 10,000 people can die for a war fought over the absurd pretext that there was a danger to Russian speakers in Ukraine. This underlying mentality, the idea that the interests of those in power are everything and the lives of those who they rule count for nothing, that was confirmed once and for all for post-Soviet Russia by the 1999 apartment buildings, and it's confirmed by the superficiality of the West, which insists on closing its eyes both to what happened and to the implications.
Mark, what about this kind of as a harbinger of how Putin governs, the role of false flags, the dramaturgia, the government by spetsoperatsia, and the sense of no limits?
Yeah, most of which exactly were already present within the Yeltsin era, so we can go back to that in due course. But if we look forward, I think one of the interesting things, just slightly sort of provocative in a way, is to say in some ways I think there are more rules now. If one looks at what's going on, you know, we're approaching Duma elections and so forth. I don't expect there's going to be any such terrible incident or whatever. Because why? Well, because they basically nowadays just rig the elections. They carousel vote. They don't bomb apartment buildings. In some ways, I think we've almost seen a normalization of the process, which I'm not saying makes it okay. But actually, I think that precisely this is a system which has bedded down to an extent. The apartment bombings was a particular extreme and appalling way of trying to rig an election after sort of previous ones which have been rigged
to
in other
rig
ways.
An election and to change the entire national conversation and yeah. Change the trajectory of where Russia was going.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was a terrible one, but I think actually what we now see is a regime that has, precisely because I think it's more solidly rooted, it can rely on control of, you know, basically monolithic control of television. It can rely on a whole variety of other means to do it. So it's not that I think it necessarily has got better. I think it just doesn't need to operate on that level. But I think a second point I'd want to make is I think we need to be careful to note that, yes, this was indeed a ghastly thing, but it was not uniquely so. And there is a risk that we actually make Russia into some kind of extraordinary outlier compared with many other. There are many, many unpleasant regimes out there. And, you know, without saying that anything positive about Donbass or any of these other cases, we need to find that delicate balance between not forgetting and excusing what are clearly crimes, but on the other hand, not therefore treating Russia as being unique in that respect.
What would you have in mind in all of those?
Well, I mean, I think in terms of there are many deeply unpleasant countries in the world. Just because you might say they don't necessarily have a single specific case. I mean, if one looks at what's going on for the obvious example would be North Korea, but you know, that's almost too easy. But one can point to other countries from Zimbabwe onwards. The question is that we always have this issue that if we treat Russia as being an entirely criminal state, with which, I mean, as David said, we shouldn't even be talking to, then in a way we are surrendering any attempt, any opportunity to actually have any kind of traction on the process.
Now, and this is something I wanted to return to at the end of the segment, and this is difficult balance, because if you look at this, this is a regime. We should that many could make a plausible argument that we shouldn't be dealing with a regime that if we believe what we're saying on this program, and I think we all believe what we're saying, this is a regime that killed 300 of its own people in order to come to power. And how do you partner with a regime like that? It's a difficult moral question. But this is something I want to return to the end. I wanted to get Don's thoughts first on also this September 1999 as a harbinger of other things, the dramaturgy.
It is a harbinger, and the qualities you mentioned, I agree with. Dramaturgia, rule by spetz operation. But more broadly, I think the absolute cynicism of the regime and the manipulativeness of the regime, which covers not only how they govern at home, but also foreign policy. These are factors that you see now. And what you see now is, I agree with Mark, but would put it a little bit differently. It bumps up, it has broken through the limits now that were there in 1999. And so, as you say, you don't have to do some of the more extreme provocations, but the idea that you have to manipulate society, whether it's about Ukraine or against the Chechens or whatever, is a tool of governance, an approach to governance that continues. I think this is uniquely Russian in that there's a raggedness to the implementation of it that you wouldn't see in some other countries, and you can name those countries, which allows David to write such very interesting and provocative books. And I think that raggedness, the sloppiness of it, also is both troubling and also characteristic of the Putin regime you see today. I find Mark's comments about other countries are the same way very interesting. That's true, but other countries, I think, because I agree with him, don't have such geopolitical aspirations. And that is, and I won't even talk about the nuclear weapons issue. That makes it extremely difficult to deal with. I don't want to put words in David's mouth. And I think it is a criminal regime, but I do think you should engage with it cautiously and when it might be productive in both ways. So I don't think the alternative is not engage and isolate or embrace. It's somewhere in the middle, even though it is a criminal regime. And that's a very, very difficult balance for policymakers to get to.
Also, another thing that strikes me about this is now we're 17 years after the fact here. A lot of evidence has come out. We pretty much, anybody that pays close attention to Russia doesn't have a lot of doubt about what happened in the fall of 1999. The three of us sitting here basically to start the whole program off, and I did that on purpose. I wanted to kind of establish that. But yet, people who believe this was an inside job and a false flag are looked at like, often treated like you're wearing a tinfoil hat, that you're a conspiracy nut. I was reading an article yesterday. Conspiracy theories still abound that the regime carried out these attacks. Why is that, given all the evidence that's out? Because this is not a case of some crackpot theory of like Elvis is still alive, or you know, the kind of the crazier stuff that's come out about 9/11. There is concrete evidence here, and it all points in one direction. Why is it, after so long, people still have trouble swallowing this?
I mean, I don't know, but I would guess that there's several reasons. One of them is a very, very human one. We don't like the thought that regimes do this kind of thing. And therefore, what I think is quite interesting is that you might say within the engaged Russia-watching community, there's very, very little serious question about whether or not this was indeed an inside job. Because they understand what this regime or what these regimes are and have been. It's actually people who aren't particularly engaged who almost think, I mean, you know, I've been in conversations where people say, well, sure, surely that kind of thing doesn't happen. That's the kind of thing you see in the movies. Mm. So, I mean, I think one reason is just simply that human level. Secondly, this is just another example of the way that the sort of the Russian information campaign operates. It doesn't try and convince people that specifically that this was by this particular terrorist group or by this foreign country. It just more or less creates this atmosphere of, oh, we'll never really know, will we? And you know, that becomes very difficult to actually get beyond because most people are not interested enough to sit and read David's books or similar. You know, it is for most people a tangential issue. And therefore, because it sounds like the stuff of action movies, they assume it is.
I was living in Moscow at the time, and I'll say it felt like the stuff of a horror movie, if you will. David, you've done your best to kind of break through this kind of information muddle and kind of get the facts out there. Why do you think that people just have a tough time coming to the obvious conclusion of what this was?
They don't want to face the implications. I mean, at the time of the Ryazan incident, the head of the KGB announced that this was a test.
The head of the FSB.
That this was a test of vigilance. And this absurd explanation, which was not taken seriously by anyone in Ryazan itself, because I went there and I talked to people, not by the police, not by the people who lived there, and not by people who were there at the time, was nonetheless accepted by the U.S. government. And at that time, it was the Clinton administration. The Bush administration, similarly, didn't want to hear and didn't want to raise the issue of the apartment bombings. Nor did it react appropriately to the Nordost and Beslan incidents. Bush is famous for having said he looked in Putin's eyes and got a sense of his soul. Well, where were his advisors? Who was advising him when he made such a ridiculous statement? I testified in 2007 about the apartment bombings with Michael McFaul, the architect of the reset policy, in 2008. How was it possible to initiate a reset policy in light of what was known about the apartment bombings and what I was saying, among others, and in the wake of the murder of Alexander Litvinenko and Anna Politkovskaya? So there's on the part of the government, definitely, and particularly of those who advise the president and have made careers as Russia specialists, there's a deep desire not to face the reality and not to think at a level that makes it possible for them really to understand what's going on. The other thing, of course, is that we're so accustomed to phony conspiracy theories in the West directed at our own government that when any time we hear something that sounds like a conspiracy theory, and this, you know, has the external appearance of a conspiracy theory until you examine the evidence and find that in fact the evidence is overwhelming that it was a conspiracy, all right, but a successful one. But people don't have the imagination to understand that what's ridiculous in one context, in the American context, is perfectly plausible in the Russian context, and in fact, the only explanation for many things that take place there. So the Russian government, in fact, is very adept at using this superficiality, both on the part of American officials and the American public. It's not necessary to disprove the accusations. You just have to create a little bit of confusion create the impression that the truth will never really be known, and that's all that's necessary to reinforce the fact that that people don't either for reasons of careers or because they're just intellectually lazy are not interested in the truth.
Now, it's interesting you raise this issue of conspiracy theories. It made me recall a conversation I had on the 9th of September, 1999, in Moscow with Boris Kagarlitsky, the sociologist. And I asked him if he thought there was a conspiracy behind these bombings. And he said, Brian, the question about conspiracies you should never ask in Russia is there a conspiracy? There's always a conspiracy. The question you should ask is, whose conspiracy is actually succeeding? And I think I have never forgotten that 17-year-old comment to this day. Don, what are your thoughts?
To be our comment, that the cliche that just because you're paranoid doesn't mean that people aren't after you. The same thing here. Americans are very naive. They find it very difficult to believe what is mainstream political discourse in Russia compared to our own. And this goes not just for issues like this, but even the kind of the far right, what we would call wackos, who are taken as being very mainstream in Russia. I'm taken with Mark's comments about the goal of creating chaos, which certainly is, I think, accepted as the currently accepted as the goal of Russian information warfare. I don't think the doctrinal development in 1999 was as full as it is today, but certainly the effect, which is to create chaos, is the same. And as Mark said, I think that's all you really need to do. That's all you really need to know. We'll never know. And it largely succeeded from the point of view of the Kremlin. And so that's pretty much where the debate is going to stop.
So you can pretty much draw a direct line from this to the events in Ukraine, MH17 and everything else, this sophisticated information warfare campaign. This wasn't its birth. Of course, these kinds of things were existing in the Yeltsin, but they were more diffuse. They weren't as organized. They weren't as sophisticated. I wanted to go back finally, just before we shift gears. I wanted to just go back to this notion of how do you engage a regime like this? Is this? I mean, Mark, you brought it up, so I'll go to you first. If we accept this, we're talking about a pretty odious regime. But yet we're talking about a regime that has a lot of geopolitical weight that you can't isolate like North Korea, that you have to deal with. How do you deal with it?
Well, this is serving me right for actually raising the issue in the first place, turning to me for the answers. I'd make a couple of points. I mean, first of all, this is a sort of slightly broader one. In some ways, it's interesting that we are talking about the apartment bombings as being such a crucial measure of this regime's odiousness. Because one could say, well, what about the Chechen wars, which led to order of magnitude greater civilian casualties and the use of thermobaric munitions on populated centres and all that kind of thing? What about things like sort of letting a submarine full of mariners drown rather than letting the Royal Navy possibly see some secrets while saving them? I mean, there is, interestingly and horrifically, a spectrum, a whole sort of array of ghastly incidents that say something about precisely that this is, as David said, a regime which historically and still today puts very, very little value on human life, except when it's its own and its friends. So what do we do with that? Well, I think, again, we accept that we have two options. We can be tremendously moral, at which point, if we're going to be properly moral, there's a whole slew of other regimes, some of which are our good and noble allies, which are also odious, quite possibly in different ways or similar ways or whatever. Or we accept that the world is indeed a grimy place. And to go back to Don's point, we have to engage with them. But, and this is, I think, the key point and where sort of David's activities are so useful, engage with open eyes. I mean, again, this was one of the crucial weaknesses of the reset, was that it was, I think it's fair to say, naive. We cannot afford to keep doing that, because every time we are naive, every time we more or less think, well, look, if we're open-hearted and open-minded, then surely they will too. We've seen the Russians smirk and take full advantage of it. So, I mean, I think in some respects, precisely because the Russians are playing a 19th century geopolitical game,
we have to too.
we have to, I mean, not become them, but we have to accept, in a way, those terms of reference and basically, you know, I identify what is and is not acceptable behaviour. And to an extent, we're beginning to do that. It's a really difficult one. There is no neat and easy answer. It is essentially about containment of the effects and a slow demonstration that everything has consequences. The most insulting way I can think about it, which is also, I think, the most accurate one, is this is slowly house training the over-large and rather vicious puppy.
But they're not. It doesn't seem like the. If you continue with that metaphor, the puppy's still.
Well, I'm not convinced. Actually, I mean, I think that, in a way, we are. Well, Crimea and the Donbass were in many ways, frankly, the product of Georgia and the reset. And frankly, the Russians clearly expected a very, very different trajectory. I mean, I remember being in Moscow at the time, and everyone was convinced 6 months and basically there'll be a reset and the sanctions will be gone and whatever. And also 6 months and Kiev would have capitulated. That's not happened. And I think, you know, again, there's a much, much more sober and downbeat mood that you encounter within the Russian security and foreign policy set these days. They realize that Donbass has gone badly and is, frankly, not going anywhere. They'll do the best they can with it, but nonetheless, it was a failure. They have been, I think, quite shocked by the extent to which, especially the Europeans, have maintained for so long their commitment to sanctions and so forth. And despite the sort of the little signals here and there, I think that commitment will continue. So actually, I mean, I think we are in a process in which that is actually happening, but it's inevitably, painfully and irritatingly, a lagging indicator. Mm-hmm. You know, just as 2014 was a product of 2008, well, you know, it's going to be years before what we do now is seriously going to affect. Mm.
Don, last word to you before we go to the second segment.
Yes, I very much like what both of my colleagues are saying. On the reset, clearly David is right. In 2007 and 8, after the Munich speech and the Georgian war and this entire record of the first Putin term, it was very clear what the regime was about, which makes the naivete of the reset authors even more misunderstandable. And frankly, it makes you wonder about a lot of these people who are now tougher on Russia, often work for Hillary, and it makes you just wonder how much flip-flopping can you do, because I very much agree with Mark. The reset was one of the things that sent the message that Russia could go further, and it's one and the same, and Russia did go further, as we've seen, with really even more bloody consequences. Finally, yes, Putin miscalculated. He miscalculated about the reaction in Donbass and Lugansk. He miscalculated the Ukrainian response. He miscalculated Germany's response, the West's response, and so forth. So this also argues that we shouldn't overly dramatize Russia's capabilities, which do have limits and are often, sometimes, the product of miscalculation. Mm-hmm.
All right, on that note, we'll shift gears. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and broaden the aperture to look at the 1999 apartment bombings in the broader context of post-Soviet Russia. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us from London is David Satter, a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, a fellow of the Foreign Policy Institute of the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, and author of the recently published book, The Less You Know, The Better You Sleep. And joining us from Washington, D.C. is veteran Kremlin watcher Donald Jensen, a former U.S. State Department official and currently a fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations in the Nietzsche School of International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfurl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
По словам кремлевских источников, президент премьер-министра Владимира Путина несколько минут назад. По словам Владимира Путина, я цитирую поэтарную.
Официальную версию было трудно поддержать даже людям.
Мы будем преследовать террористов везде. Мы и в сортире их замочим, в конце концов. Все.
The 1999 apartment building bombings, as shocking and significant as they were, did not happen, of course, in isolation. they came in the death throes of the regime of Boris Yeltsin and his cronies, sinisterly known then as the Family, a regime that consolidated power just 6 years earlier by shelling parliament into submission. And they were followed by years of terrorist attacks in Russia, the Nord-Ost theater siege in 2002, the Beslan massacre in 2004, as well as bombings in the Moscow metro and of Russian airlines. David, in your book, you suggest that there is a thread here that ties this all together, the role that terrorism has played in not just the Putin regime, but also the Yeltsin regime that preceded it. Give us your nut graph. Give us your Cliff Notes version of the argument there.
Well, the privatization was so corrupt, and it was so detrimental to the population of Russia. We often forget that the 1990s were an era of spectacularly elevated mortality in Russia. The demographic category of surplus deaths is applied to deaths that could not have been anticipated on the basis of pre-existing conditions. And that figure for Russia in the 1990s was 6 million. And this was at a time when the country was producing a small number of super rich individuals who were called oligarchs. And the economy of the country was basically destroyed. So to save a regime that was responsible for that kind of misrule, it was necessary, really, to have a provocation, and that provocation would almost certainly have to be the prelude to another war, which is exactly what happened. The 300 persons who were killed in the Terrorist Act of 1999. Were just the beginning of the innocent victims, because thousands and thousands of persons were killed in the unnecessary Second Chechen War, which was launched in order to bring Putin to power. So once he was in power, of course, he had to protect that war, and he had to protect it not only against popular discontent in Russia, because enthusiasm for any war begins to fade, but also against various attempts by the West to mediate the conflict and settle it on something less than total victory for the Putin regime, because this was the war that legitimated Putin. If that war is in any way seen to be illegitimate or the subject of compromise, the regime itself becomes weakened. And that was why we witnessed first the Nord-Ost theater siege and then the Beslan school massacre. In both cases, these are provocations in which there's ample evidence that the government was involved and not necessarily carrying out the terrorist act itself, but making it possible for that act to be carried out, so that the peace process in Chechnya could then be discredited. And the pattern was continued for the rest of the post-Soviet period. The war in Georgia consolidated the authority of Medvedev in his brief period as kind of puppet ruler of Russia under Putin's tutelage. The war in Ukraine was essential because it distracted the attention of the Russian people. It was another diversionary, just as the first and second Chechen wars were intended to divert attention from the misrule of the authorities and to serve their purposes. Same thing in the case of the invasion of Ukraine. This was intended to redirect the attention of the Russian people to the supposed persecution of Russian speakers, so that they won't begin to pay attention to how it's possible to peacefully overthrow a kleptocratic regime, as was done in the Euromaidan revolt. And then when that effort faltered, of course, the next step was to intervene in Syria. So war and provocation became fundamental instruments of internal policy, and they grew out of the lawlessness of the reform period, which, by the way, was warmly supported by the uninformed policies of the U.S. And the pattern is likely to continue because the regime that was created in Russia is inherently unstable. And it may look solid now, but it has little ability to withstand external shocks. And I don't think we've seen the end of the war and provocation as instrument of internal policy. I think that the future is pregnant with all kinds of unpleasant surprises.
Now, Mark, now, on one hand, if you look at this, I mean, the September 1999 bombings were kind of bracketed by terrorist attacks on both ends that were not false flags. Mm-hmm. As David said, they were exploited in some cases by the authorities for their own ends. But you had Budionovsk during the Yeltsin period and other terrorist attacks that were actually real terrorist attacks. Mm-hmm. In the Putin period, you had, as I mentioned, the Nordost. You had Beslan. You had airlines being blown up. You had the bombing of the Moscow metro. Why has terrorism been such a central feature of this regime? It's almost like it's one of its kind of unifying principles.
Well, I think there's a danger. I mean, look, this is a regime which, from the 1990s, was involved in successive sort of wars in the North Caucasus, and in the first Chechen war, one of the lessons that the Chechens soon learnt was that they could use terrorism as a form of asymmetric warfare, and that's a lesson that continued. Precisely because this is, to use Don's word, a rather sort of ragged regime and security apparatus in so many ways. You know, it's relatively large, but it's got a lot of targets to try and protect. It's not always very good at preventing terrorist attacks. I don't necessarily think that therefore shows that the regime connived at them or was happy to see them. I think it's just actually that when you are fighting a domestic terror campaign, it's very hard not to have attacks go through. I mean, if one thinks that the British security apparatus, which is actually a highly efficient one, nonetheless, they could not prevent the IRA from launching attacks even on the British mainland. So I think, and this is just one of the things, if you're going to fight wars in the North Caucasus, and particularly the sorts of deeply unpleasant wars which leave lots of embittered widows and children and parents, then you're going to find that war also being visited within your sort of rump state as well.
But that's one side of the equation, and I would agree with all of that. But the other side of the equation, this is a regime that has also used the terror card to its advantage fairly effectively.
Sure. I mean, well, it's an interesting question as to how effectively. It'll obviously spin the way that, look, every regime spins circumstances to its own advantage. But I'm not actually convinced that we can necessarily look at the rather bloody history of recent Russia purely from the point of view of provocations or spun sort of incidents for political purpose. I mean, in this, I would disagree with David. Things like, I mean, Georgia, for example, I don't think it was about shoring up Medvedev. I think it was about establishing Russia's position within its so-called near abroad. The Second Chechen War, yes, of course, it was in part about consolidating Putin's position and showing that he's a strong leader and that he can do what Yeltsin could not, mm-hmm. Apart from walking unaided. but at the same time, this was a war which was anyway close to being triggered. Maskhadov was losing his grip on Chechnya. Chechnya was becoming more and more unstable. You actually had more and more cross-border incidents and so forth. So that, even if actually there hadn't been Putin looking for a pretext, probably some kind of military operation would have been launched. And once it was launched, of course, it had to be successful and overwhelming, given that they didn't want to be fighting a third Chechen war. So, I mean, all I would say is I think that, yes, on the one hand, we definitely have a regime that is not averse to the direct use of violence. It is also not averse to exploiting violent situations to its own advantage. That's absolutely true. But I also think it's a regime that's operating within a very kind of complex political environment, and therefore we have to appreciate that there's a lot of different pressures.
Don, your thoughts? I think you look to be writing.
Discussion. 3 points. I think without being an expert on all those incidents we've been talking about, I think there are incidents such as this one that are planned and organized by the regime. And there are others which more reflect the old bromide that you can't let a good crisis go to waste. I think there may well be a difference in how the regime treated each one. I think there likely is. Second, Brian, you talked about terrorism as a tool of governance, and I think that's absolutely true. But I would put it more broadly, the need to mobilize society behind the regime is, I think, the impulse of which terror, anti-terrorism, or is one of those weapons. And I think as the society absorbs this drug, as we've seen in Ukraine, it does get sort of numb to the crisis. I think the recent polling when Levada was available showed that the interest in Ukraine, for example, is less than it was. The third comment I'd like to make is this whole issue of continuity between the 90s and now, which is probably a whole separate program. And I would bracket this incident with the 93 shootout as the twin pillars of the regime, because I think there is a lot more continuity than people give the regime credit for. There's a lot more continuity than people talk about, even as I resent the fact that the Kremlin now demonizes the 90s into something that it was not. To get to a point we made earlier in the program, this was not probably organized by Putin. This was organized by the elites to perpetuate the regime, which then evolved in other directions after 1999. So there's considerable continuity in this. And I think it was you or Brian or Mark who mentioned the family being kernel of the planning for this. And the family eventually was cast aside. But a lot of the parameters have been very, 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 very much the same now as they were in 1999 and 1995. The U.S. just turned its back in 1993 to what happened. That in many ways also established the foundation for what's going on now.
Yeah, the shelling of the parliament. I mean, at the time, it was seen broadly as a victory for democracy, and it was anything but.
I wrote the cables from the U.S. Embassy.
I can't believe you said that on mic.
I'm not going to tell you what I said. But remember, there were three things. One was the shooting of the parliament, and the second were the snap elections, and the third was the new constitution. All of which came within a very short period of 2 or 3 months, all of which sort of turned a blind eye to what went on in the streets. And I think the strong Yeltsin presidency, and it was really designed for him, I think, the new constitution. All of that stuff happened 1, 2, 3, and then the rationalization was, well, this pushes through reform. And in fact, of course, it did not.
Yeah, no, and I've often made the contrast with Ukraine, which was facing a similar political crisis to Russia in 93, 94, and the way Ukraine resolved their crisis was entirely different. They had early elections, and the incumbent president lost and stepped down, and I think you really can trace this kind of separated at birth development from that moment, because what Ukraine is today, it was largely born in the summer of 94 when they had those elections, and what we see in Russia today was largely born in October 93. It kind of went on steroids in September 1999, though, in a lot of ways. And one of the reasons, again, going back to what Mark was talking about, one of the reasons that September 99 was the official line on it was so believable to so many people at the time was because it was preceded by a series of very real terrorist attacks. So the fact that this could happen wasn't that big of an isolation and escalation in the eyes of a lot of people. No, I mean the stage.
Sure,
was set.
Exactly. I think, but this is it. This is how you launch a successful provocation, spetsoperatsiya, whatever you want to call it, is you make it something that is plausible. If it had been absolutely out of nowhere, if there had been no credible terrorist threat, then that wouldn't have worked. They'd have had to think of something else. Maybe then it would have been precisely some major financial scam or something like that. No, I mean, you know, you you take the circumstances. You basically, you rip your spetsoperatsiya from the day's headlines.
Right. Well, the irony at the time, I was in Moscow at the time, as were you, Don. I mean, the irony was that the rumors in Moscow at that time, if I remember correctly, were that that emergency rule was going to be declared. And that the elections were going to be canceled, and that Yeltsin was just going to stay in power, and the family was going to stay in power basically indefinitely. What they came up with this instead, but then this turned into be almost a coup, because the regime that came to power after this was not terribly loyal to the regime that left power, as similar as those two regimes were. David, last word to you, since it's your fault we're doing this before we wrap it up for the week.
Well, I think that the Putin regime actually was relatively loyal, because if they had been disloyal, Yeltsin and his entourage would have ended up in prison. Yeltsin and Putin made a deal. There would be no revision of privatization, and Yeltsin would not be held responsible for any criminal acts that he committed while in office. And he kept his bargain.
Yeah, but Berezovsky and the others were not included in that bargain.
Berezovsky and Kharkovsky, for the most part, the oligarchs who made their fortunes under Yeltsin kept their money, and they retained. They lost political power, but they remained enormously rich and were able to enjoy their stolen money. There were two big exceptions. Berezovsky, because having engineered the accession of Putin, he pretended to a bigger role than Putin was willing to give him, and Kharkovsky, who also mounted a political challenge. But for those who were not in a position to, or not interested in succeeding politically and having political influence, which in the case of most of them was just a means to make money anyway, they moved comfortably from the Yeltsin period to the Putin period. If you look at the present-day Putin oligarchs, of course their numbers have been replenished by people from the FSB and persons in government, but the core oligarchs are those who were created by Yeltsin.
With some exceptions, yeah, that's certainly true. All right, well, on that note, we will wrap it up for this week. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio has been co-host Mark Galeotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Joining us from London has been David Satter, a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute and a fellow at the Foreign Policy Institute of Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, and author of the recently published book, The Less You Know, The Better You Sleep. And joining us from Washington, D.C. has been veteran Kremlin watcher Donald Jensen, a former U.S. State Department official and currently a fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations in the Nietzsche School of International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Thank you, gentlemen, for a lively and enlightening discussion.
Pleasure.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.